Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and reading with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
My guest today is a war correspondent with over a decade of combat experience, beginning with the invasion of Iraq. Ann Scott Tyson is a Pulitzer Prize nominee who has worked for the Christian Science Monitor, the Washington Post, and UPI. She is a graduate of Harvard University with an honors degree in government and studied economics and business at Columbia University. She has also worked as a foreign correspondent in Asia and speaks fluent Mandarin Chinese and French. In 2010, Ann Scott Tyson wrote a piece for the Washington Post about a U.S. Army Special Forces major named Jim Gant. And she has now written a book about this charismatic and controversial commander, American Spartan, The Promise, the Mission, and the Betrayal of Special Forces Major Jim Gant. Ann Scott Tyson, welcome.
It's good to be here.
With us in the studio is the commander himself, Jim Gant, a man who changed the face of America's war in Afghanistan when his critical white paper, One Tribe at a Time, went viral at the Pentagon, the White House, and on Capitol Hill in 2009. This decorated Green Beret and the war correspondent fell in love and are now married and living in Seattle, Washington. Jim Gant, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, you two live in Seattle, so what brings you to Chico?
Well, my parents have lived here for about 25 years. My dad has been a longtime professor of economics and finance at Chico State University. They love it here.
So that probably influenced your studying economics yourself at one point.
It did. I used to get lectures, and my dad would run me through everything from, all sorts of financial topics, and it was great growing up with him.
Well, why don't you say who your parents are, because you dedicate the book to both of you, to your parents.
Yes, Joy and Haney Scott, longtime residents of Chico.
Well, I was impressed with them. Now, your mother, actually, I knew over 20 years ago when she was a volunteer at KCHO. It was KCHO then. So I had known your mother and I met your dad. But what impressed me was that they raised such an independent daughter. You're going all over the world?
Well, you know, they actually have a lot to do with that. My dad and mom went overseas. He taught in Britain early in their marriage when my brother was born in Great Britain. He went overseas with us as a family when I was a young girl to live in Ireland. He had a Fulbright there and later took us to live in Greece. So my then graduating from college and venturing to Asia was just a continuation of exploring the world that they had led me to love as a child.
So how long were you? You were in China.
Yes.
How long were you there?
I was there for about 8 years altogether and really, really loved that culture, learned the language, and it was a great challenge to work there as a reporter.
So how did you then end up going to Iraq?
Well, I was not interested that much in the Middle East or the military, but after the 9/11 terrorist attacks that happened when I was in the Washington area, then with my young children, I felt that I needed to respond to the request of my editor who asked me to start covering the Pentagon. I hesitated initially, but I felt that I was a trained journalist, and both for the benefit of my newspaper and our readership and my family itself, I needed to be engaged and stay informed in what was happening with these wars. I quickly realized that there was a great gap between the world of the military and the public's understanding of it, that there was even my editors at the newspaper didn't understand the very basics of military organization and operations. And so I felt that this was a new role, whereas I had lived in China and come to see myself as a translator between China and the American public, that similarly with the military, I needed to play that role of a translator.
Of a foreign culture. The military was a foreign culture to the rest of America.
It was a foreign culture, and the public's Understanding of that was vital when the public was approving, in a sense, our decisions to go to war.
My guests are Ann Scott Tyson and Jim Gant. Her book is American Spartan. She's the author, and the book is about her husband, who was not your husband at this point in the story, Jim Gant. So you're assigned to the Pentagon, and you're thinking you want to do something about this gap in knowledge, and you have four young children.
Yes, I did. And I had been working at home for about 16 years to make sure I was there for my children. So it was a very, very wrenching decision to decide when the time came. So in 2001, I began covering the Pentagon, and then in 2003, the preparations for the Iraq War began. And I realized that at that time, I was the only reporter on the staff who had the level of knowledge necessary to make sense of what was about to happen. So I thought about it very hard, and then I let my editor know that I was willing to go. And that was very difficult because at that time I knew that there was a chance that I might not come back.
Yeah, because you weren't going over and spending your time in a luxury hotel. You were really out there on the front lines.
I was embedded with the main force that spearheaded the invasion of Iraq, the U.S. Army's 3rd Infantry Division. And it was extremely difficult, and yet it was an experience that did help me begin. I would only say begin to understand psychologically what happens when soldiers go into harm's way, and when the leadership of our country asks them to take on a mission. And I felt my children had very, very different reactions to it. I mean, as the invasion was going on, my oldest son occasionally talked to them on the phone, and he would say, you know, Mom, they're crossing the Euphrates, and it was telling me what was going on. And my youngest daughter very innocently said, Mom, please just don't go to the moon.
My guest is Ann Scott Tyson. She's written a book, American Spartan, The Promise, The Mission, and the Betrayal of Special Forces Major Jim Gant. And American Spartan, that's you, Jim Gant.
That is me. That is me.
And how, in what way did you consider yourself, or did you, a Spartan?
Well, I had joined the military, you know, when I was really young, right out of high school, and had gone into special forces and done a bunch of different things. And then I went to college, became a lieutenant in the infantry. So I became an officer, a leader. And it was really apparent how much those young men needed leadership. And so I read a lot, and I was given a book, Gates of Fire, by Stephen Pressfield. And it really, it talked about the Spartans and the Battle of Thermopylae and their ethos and their way of life. And it just really made concrete and colorful to me that culture, what it meant to be a warrior, what it meant to be a leader. And so I adopted those as my own, and how I wanted to treat the men under my command. And so we adopted that call sign, we adopted that patch, and after the invasion in Afghanistan, that was what me and my men rallied around in both Afghanistan and Iraq. And so it was just something that became just ingrained in all of us that we would fight and die if necessary, accomplishing our mission.
Well, you excelled as a soldier. In fact, then, Anne, when did you become aware of the existence of this person, Jim Gant?
Well, in 2007, when I had been covering Iraq for some time and the conflict was growing more and more violent, I learned from the military of an opportunity to interview Major Jim Gant, who had recently earned a Silver Star, fighting alongside a group of Iraqi policemen that he had mentored, and he had a small U.S. advisory team that was working with these Iraqis. And what was very extraordinary about it was the connection that he had with the Iraqis he was he was working with. This was an effort in Iraq that had, you know, many many bad starts, and many of the Iraqi forces were unmotivated and unwilling to fight to try to secure their country. But in this case, he had inspired them. And when I interviewed him, I was given the chance to interview him, and I realized during that interview, I was actually in Washington at that time, and we talked on the phone. But I could tell from his description that he had really delved into, in this case, the Shia Iraqi culture, their background, where they lived in Baghdad, understood their fears, understood their concerns for their families. And so apart from the heroics of the battle, this very, very vicious battle through which they emerged and for which he was awarded the Silver Star, I gained an insight into how much he cared about the Iraqis and how well he understood them, which made an impression on me.
My guest is a war correspondent, Ann Scott Tyson, and she has written a book about a decorated Green Beret named Jim Gant. And so you then first interview this gentleman, this war hero, because he has won this award. He is a hero. But then you later find out about this white paper that he's written that caught the attention all over Washington. And there's a section in your book that I would like to read. This takes place on October the 26th, 2009. And maybe one of you'd like to read that section.
On October 26, 2009, Jim had rocked the U.S. military establishment by publishing a treatise on why it was destined to lose the war in Afghanistan. In the online paper, One Tribe at a Time, posted on a website popular in military circles, Jim exposed a gaping hole in the U.S. strategy, the failure to systematically engage Afghanistan's powerful Pashtun tribes. The Pashtuns make up 40% of the population, including the majority of the Taliban insurgents, and occupy the volatile east and south. Jim argued that as the tribes go, so goes the rest of the nation. With the Pashtuns behind you, Afghanistan was won.
This is Ann Scott Tyson. She is a war correspondent. She is was a journalist with, for example, the Washington Post. And her husband, Jim Gant, has written a paper that was online, and this was based on your experience in Iraq, right? So when you went to Afghanistan, you already knew the importance of living with the people there.
Yes, and it was also it was based on 2 deployments to Afghanistan, as well as 15 months fighting in Iraq, It was pretty clear that we were losing the war. It was pretty clear that we had to drastically change what it was that we were doing. And with the help of some of my background, some of my training, and my good friend Stephen Pressfield, who coincidentally had just finished writing a book about Afghanistan and Alexander the Great, you know, we just got to talking, and he said, "Jim, you got to write this down. You got to get this out to people." So I probably would not have written the paper and finished it had I not made the promise to him that I would. And so he pushed me to do it, and I did it. And the rest is kind of history.
Well, in this strategy, and I think in the book it's referred to as the tribal engagement strategy, and what did it consist of? What was your recommendation? What were you saying that was wrong that could be improved, could be done differently?
Well, specifically in Afghanistan, there has always been historically issues with the central government and the tribal people. And there has never been a very strong central government. They have always been at odds with one another. I had a very strong belief that the war in Afghanistan was being fought in the Pashtun tribal belt, which is the southern portion of Afghanistan and the eastern portion of Afghanistan, which, oh, by the way, is extremely tribal. There was a huge problem with the strategy in that we were not engaging a vast majority of the population. who I thought would be able to bring security in the area.
And this is what the top brass was not understanding.
Yeah, we were not doing that. We were paying lip service to it. We were kind of saying that we were trying to build up this central government and this large Afghan national army that historically and at the time was just not having any impact on a vast majority of the people that live there. So I thought it was absolutely critical that we get out there and we empower them, give them a say in the government, and they did not want to be under Taliban rule either. So if we could harness that and work and fight alongside them, that they were the only ones that were going to be able to turn the tide of the war.
And when you say get out there, you don't mean just say, okay, gentlemen, good morning and good afternoon, and you go back to your base, your secure, safe base. What do you actually do when you say get out there?
Well, one of the things that I have learned is that it is very easy to make decisions from behind a desk or the safety of a military base. It's also very easy as an American to build these bases, even in remote locations with big walls and machine guns and all this stuff to protect yourself. It's very easy to think that you know what is best. That changes overnight when you are living right
eating, sleeping, dressing like they do.
When you are a member of that tribe, when you are out there, you don't have the big walls, you don't have the helicopters, you don't have the jets, you don't have, you know, all the protection. You immediately realize the extent that you are exposed, that they are exposed, and it just changes your outlook overnight.
Here's a quote from Anne's book. She, this Special Forces team of sergeants says, the real battles are unfolding in a sheikh's house, squatting on the desert, eating with my right hand and smoking Turkish cigarettes, and trying to influence tribes to rise up against an insurgency. And he's saying that that's where the real battles are. You go out and you squat with the people in the tribes.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, to be clear, you know, you have to be able to back up, you know, you're talking with violence and that it's not all about three cups of tea. It's not all about doing that. You have to be able to back up what you say. At the same time, just going down there with bombs and bullets is not going to do it. I used to tell them all the time, I'm never going to run out of bombs and bullets. But we can try to talk this out. And that was something that I even worked very, very hard to do, that Ann saw on a daily basis with the Taliban. I spent a lot of time and effort trying to, and did sit down with the Taliban to see if there was any way that we could stop the fighting.
Well, you were saying that it didn't mean you didn't have weapons, and so Anne then comes to Afghanistan. Well, actually, it wasn't that easy. It wasn't just like you got on a plane and you arrived in Afghanistan. You decided you wanted to go to Afghanistan, and how did you do that?
Well, I had spent a lot of time embedded with military units, but in this case, I knew that with a special forces unit, you could only, at the most, gain permission to spend maybe a day with them, and that was just not going to allow me to capture this experience. I was at that time a book author, and I made an official application to the military. Will you approve me spending time with Jim and his unit to document this? And they essentially said no. So at that time, I had to decide, as many journalists do, to go around the official restrictions. And we figured out that I could get onto a contractor flight, fly it directly onto a base near his location.
Without an entry stamp on your visa.
Without an entry stamp on my passport. And if he just met me there because I put down a military contact, then we could slip through. And so we slipped through a loophole, which was actually sort of a gaping security loophole, but obviously not that many people would take advantage of it. And so we slipped through that loophole, and that allowed me to get to the village and to start to integrate myself as a member of his team while capturing everything that was happening. As an aside, I also was doing some contracting work to bring school supplies and to engage with the women in the village to discuss the possibility of setting up a getting female teachers for their school. So I was also had a minor role in promoting the mission through on the development side.
Now, meanwhile, you had given up your post, your job at the Washington Post.
That's right. I realized that there was no way to do this reporting and have to respond to editors' demands. I needed to have complete autonomy to carry this out. And I realized that, again, because I was taking a huge risk and I was moving well beyond the traditional journalistic role, and that I needed to do that as an author, not as a reporter.
So you show up in this place where Jim is working, and what kind of skills do you have as far as soldier skills? Jim, what did you do?
Well, I think he realized that I needed to be trained just like all of his guys. So he, I was used to moving and patrolling with units, but he went beyond that. He gave me first aid medical training. They showed me how to put on a tourniquet, how to, you know, stuff bandages into open wounds. They taught me how to fire every weapon they had, from 9mm pistol to M4 and AK-47 rifle up to the big guns that are on their trucks. I drilled with them in maneuvers, in live fire maneuvers, so that should the worst case scenario arise, obviously that was not my main job, but if push came to shove, I would be capable of helping the team in a combat environment.
And that's something that I had always done ever since 2003. A lot of teams or units would let people just attach themselves and go out for a mission or something like that. I never allowed that to happen. Anyone that would ever show up that would go out on patrol with me had to know how to fire all the weapon systems, run all the communication gear, and be able to do combat trauma. I felt like I owed the members of my team that, and this individual person that, whoever it was. And in that regard, Ann was no different. We didn't have very many guys. If something went wrong, Ann needed to be able to shoot weapons, get on the radio, and perform life-saving medical procedures. And she did that. She did that.
My guests are war correspondent Ann Scott Tyson and Green Beret Special Forces Major Jim Gant. The title of the book is American Spartan. Now, the two of you are working together. So you say, Jim, that Ann really became your advisor. And there were other people in the role of advisor. And you say that your interpreters were advisors and as well as interpreters, and brothers.
Absolutely. When I was in Iraq, I became extremely close to my interpreter there, a young man named Mac. And he never left my side, ever. And
there were bodyguards. That was another role that they served.
Absolutely.
As a bodyguard for you.
Absolutely. I never went anywhere without Mac. And, it doesn't really. You can read. You can learn the language. You can do all kinds of things. But there are nuances. There are small things about these places, Iraq and Afghanistan, that there's just absolutely no way that you're going to be able to decipher or learn unless you're there on the ground. So I had Mac in Iraq, and then actually when I went to Afghanistan, one of my biggest problems when I initially got there, I could not find the proper interpreter. And I went back and forth and interviewed over
20. Because interpreters bring their own personality to the job.
Absolutely. And they are at great, great risk. The second that they do that, not only are they at great risk, but their families as well. It took me several months, and I finally got two brothers, Abe and Ish, and the mission would not have been accomplished without them. I would not be alive today without them. Ann wouldn't be alive today without them. The mission would have failed, and it's just one of the one of the most wonderful relationships that that you can ever have. And as a matter of fact, we're working really, really hard now to get all the brothers to the States. We've got one of them to the States, and we're working very, very hard. I didn't make decisions without them.
This was at your own initiative, because kind of officially the U.S. says, well, thank you very much for your service. We're out of here, and they're left hanging.
Yes.
So just on your own initiative, you want to save these people who have saved your life.
Absolutely. It's something that I feel that we have to do.
Yeah, and I think that Jim really skillfully would match these. Actually, there were three of the brothers with his different missions. You know, one was very, very fierce, and the other was a real diplomat. The third had a, you know, yet a different personality. And they have all worked for the U.S. military for several years. One of them was engaged in a Medal of Honor battle for which a U.S. soldier later was posthumously awarded the Medal of Honor. But the United States government does have a program to grant such people visas. However, it is very cumbersome, it is very slow moving, and hundreds of them have been bogged down in a background check bureaucracy that is just simply not serving them. And so we are pushing to improve that and to get these young men the opportunity that they've deserved by serving our country and risking their lives and going through really everything that U.S. soldiers go through.
My guests are Commander Jim Gant, and Ann Scott is a war correspondent. She has written the book, American Spartan, The Promise, The Mission, and the Betrayal of Special Forces, Major Jim Gant. And Ann, you actually, your experience as a writer has been as a journalist. So when you decide you're going to write this book, did you have to rewrite it? From changing roles from being a journalist, an objective reporter, to being an author of a book like this?
I actually did. I pretty much had two cracks at this book. And my initial instinct as a reporter, something just so deeply ingrained in me, is to keep my viewpoints, my opinions, myself completely out of it. My favorite situation would be to be out with the military and have everyone behave as though I just wasn't even there. I was a fly on the wall, soaking up everything to reflect what was happening with myself invisible. In this case, I was part of the story. And I think my editor at HarperCollins wisely recognized that I needed to go outside of my comfort zone, which it really was doing, push myself to talk about myself, talk about my own feelings and reactions, because people needed to encounter Afghanistan and the wonderful Afghans that we came to know and love through my eyes. And so I was not comfortable in doing this, but I did it for that, what I considered the greater good. And had to wear many hats and tell the story through a much broader variety of views than only the traditional journalistic view.
My guests are war correspondent Ann Scott Tyson and her husband, U.S. Army Special Forces Major Jim Gant. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, Ann Tyson will tell us why Osama bin Laden wanted her husband killed. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. Thank you. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guests are war correspondent Ann Scott Tyson and U.S. Army Special Forces Major Jim Gant, who was the subject of her book, American Spartan. Well, this is part two in this discussion of your book. Ann is the one who wrote the book, American Spartan. And we learned a little bit about the backgrounds of each of you, but maybe people didn't catch the first part of this. Just briefly tell us, Ann, how you got involved in writing a book about Afghanistan and this person who is now your husband.
Well, I had, as you noted, I had been out on patrol with military units in Iraq and Afghanistan for many years, and so much wanted to see some positive change in those wars. I read his paper, One Tribe at a Time, and it made great sense to me. It encompassed the idea of understanding the local people, working hand in glove with them to meet their needs, to forward their security with the support of the U.S. military. The sensitivity to the culture made a lot of sense to me, and I came to believe that this, from all my experience, that this could make a difference, a big difference in the Afghanistan war. And therefore, it was just a topic that was worth me stepping out of this military coverage and devoting all of my energies to.
Well, and you were really on the front lines. I mean, you were shot. You've been shot at. You've been in a car that was bombed. So you have put yourself at risk to do this reporting.
Yeah, I guess I believed that early on in the conflicts that if I didn't really truly experience what combat was like and what it did to men and women, that I could not do my job. I could never do this job sitting in the Pentagon briefing room, listening to officials and looking at slides. And I would make these trips to Iraq and Afghanistan and come back and find out that senior people like the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff or the defense secretary weren't really exactly clear on what was happening on the ground. So I decided that I had to do that in order to do my job.
Well, and that went along, Jim, with your strategy of not sitting at a base safe and secure and just going out during the day and coming back. But you felt, well, what did you feel about the war? And when you were in Iraq, for example?
Well, in Iraq, I had a much different mission. It was a kill or capture mission. And our mission was to just to kill and capture insurgent and terrorist leaders. That was pretty much it. But even with a mission like that, I quickly came to realize that even with that very, you know, direct action type of mission, that it would boil down to relationships anyway. It would boil down to the relationship that I had with my counterpart, with my Iraqi commander, with the relationship that I was able to build with his soldiers, the relationships that they were going to be able to build with the community, both Sunni and Shia, to either gather intelligence or to help people that needed it. Even in a mission in Iraq that was extremely violent, where we pretty much went after people every single day, when you really studied it, when you really looked at it, it came down to individual relationships, and that's what even enabled that type of mission to be successful. So when you go to Afghanistan and you're trying to engage local populaces to provide their own security, it becomes much more important to be able to do that.
So you then are sent to Afghanistan officially as a part of your role, mm-hmm, as a commander. Anne, however, goes to Afghanistan on her own initiative without permission. So the two of you then begin working together, and you train Anne all that she needs to know in order to be a part of your team.
Yes.
And you write this paper about describing your strategy that is read by the Pentagon, Capitol Hill, the White House. And you say in that strategy that that we should send a small number of troops out there. And what else did did you say that you felt the strategy should be, this tribal engagement strategy?
Well, one of the things you just mentioned, we had to keep it as small as possible. Okay, one of the things that we do is we go into places, we build these big bases, we put hundreds of soldiers on them. We become occupiers. We become this, you know, this monster, this Martian out there. I felt like it was very important to keep a very small number of people or a small footprint. I also felt like it was absolutely critical to not disrupt their lives in any type of major way. To one of the things that we talk about a lot is to assimilate.
For example, in the photographs, there were a lot of photographs in the book, but I had to look carefully to pick you out because you look just like one of the Afghans.
Absolutely. And I worked very hard to do that. And,
you were dressed like them. You had a beard.
Absolutely. Carried the same weapons, spoke the language, things like that. A lot of times over in Afghanistan, the American soldiers they're in their helmet and their body armor and they're in their big
camouflage suits
and all that. And right off the bat, that is intimidating. And it's scary for children, and it's, I worked really, really hard. And I also, as a very important part of this, trained and expected my men to do the same. And on that note, they weren't Special Forces qualified guys. They didn't have
because you might mention who Special Forces are, who Green Berets are.
Yeah, well, Special Forces is a part of a special operations community specific to the United States Army. A lot of people get confused about who Special Forces are. When we're talking about United States Army Special Forces, we're talking about Green Berets. We're not talking about SEALs. We're not talking about, JSOC.
But they're still an elite group.
They're a very elite group with the specific mission to go in and train and advise indigenous or local populations. One of the problems is that in Afghanistan, and I was a part of this early on, we drifted from that. We got we received the mission to kill and capture terrorists and insurgent leaders, and I was a part of that. And so as the war continued on, we drifted further and further away of the core and primary mission of why we were made in the first place, which is to fight alongside local and indigenous people. And we had drifted from that. And I thought it was extremely, extremely important, not only for the overall strategy in Afghanistan, but also Special Forces to get back to that mission for us to do that.
My guests are Major Jim Gant and the author of American Spartan about Jim is war correspondent Ann Scott Tyson. So when you outline this strategy and everybody is reading this called One Tribe at a Time, including, and you didn't know this at the time, somebody very high up in the enemy camp read this. And, well, I'd like you to read from the book. There's in Anne starts out the book with this scene, Jim, where you, where bin Laden has just been killed. And what do you do with this knife, this Spartan knife?
Well, it was a very critical time. And the killing of Osama bin Laden is in a lot of ways a lot more important than a lot of people realize. At the same time, it wasn't going to win the war. I thought it was very important to let all the Afghans that I was with know.
Because we sitting at home probably thought, oh, bin Laden's dead, the war's over, everything's fine, case closed.
Absolutely, and a lot of people thought that. It was very important, and I wanted to make sure that both the Afghans that we were fighting alongside and the Americans that were there with me knew the importance of what killing Osama bin Laden meant for our country and theirs. And quickly before I read this, they are a honor-based society. They're an honor-based culture. They understand a lot more than anyone realizes about retribution, about hospitality, about revenge, about things like that. And so, all
in fact, you mentioned hospitality, and there's this concept that if even your enemy comes to visit in your home, you treat him as a guest.
Yes, it's something called melmastia. They are by far the most hospitable people that I have ever been around. And in fact, I had learned that in 2003 in the Pesh River Valley, which is a very violent place, where we could actually go in, try to talk, try to work things out, sit down, eat lunch together, drink chai together, and then they would say, "Hey, you know, we're gonna try to kill you once we get you back across the river." And I would say, "Okay, we'll see you in a few minutes, and we'll fight that out." So they're a very honor-based society, and this was an opportunity to talk about that.
Okay, so who else is in this scene when you're talking to? Who are you talking
to? All of the Americans that were with me, which was about a dozen, and somewhere between 20 and 30 of what we called Afghan local police, or the tribal security forces that we lived with. And so what I had a couple of my soldiers unveil an American flag. Now, as part of this, I also thought it was very important that the Afghans also see the good in Americans. And I went out of my way to be culturally sensitive. I went out of my way to do it. But at the same time, I'm an American. And I was and am very proud of that, proud to be a U.S. soldier, proud of what it was that we were doing. And this was an opportunity, which I didn't stand up on the hood of my vehicle screaming, "I'm an American," but it was an opportunity to say, "I am proud to be an American. I am proud of my country. I'm proud of my president. I'm proud of this decision, and we will get our revenge. It may take 10 years. It may take 100, which, oh, by the way, is a Pashtun proverb. If it takes us 100 years to get our revenge, then it will take 100 years. So that is the scene.
So you're addressing this group, and
I'm addressing the group. Gant drew an 8-inch Spartan Harsay knife, a gift from the father of a fallen Special Forces teammate. As a captain, Gant had embraced the Spartan warrior ethos of sacrifice and courage and used it to inspire every unit he'd commanded. Gant believed in the depth of his being that men had to be willing to die for one another without hesitation if they were to be victorious in battle. He also believed that the ancient code of honor that Spartans lived by was, at its core, no different from the one that underpinned Pashtun tribal law. "Today was a long time in coming for us," Gant said, his face drawn and voice tense. "Some 18 hours earlier, on May 2nd, 2011, U.S. Navy SEALs had stormed a fortified three-story house in Abbottabad. They'd gunned down Osama bin Laden and packed up a treasure trove of al-Qaeda's strategic and tactical plans, as well as its leaders' personal effects."
This is Major Jim Gant reading from a book written by his wife, Ann Scott Tyson, who was a war correspondent, and she wrote the book American Spartan: The Promise, the Mission, and the Betrayal of Special Forces Major Jim Gant. And Ann, why was Jim a threat to Osama bin Laden? Why did bin Laden consider Jim a threat?
Well, the Jim strategy of recruiting local tribal people, I mean, Afghanistan, again, has always been dominated by powerful tribes. They make up the fabric of Afghanistan society. So Afghanistan is a largely rural country. The Taliban comes from these Pashtun tribes. So to recruit those tribes and turn them against the Taliban would essentially break the back of the insurgency. The tribes are particularly strong in eastern Afghanistan, in Konar, where Jim was operating. So as soon as this strategy was being put into place, the Taliban let it be known that their number one target were going to be these tribally recruited police. That was how great a threat they viewed it, because the Taliban and other insurgent groups, and including the al-Qaeda elements, needed to have space and geographic control of places such as Konar, very rugged mountainous, where they could move supplies, men, and equipment to continue to wage this. They needed to have safety among those rural villages. They needed to be able to stop and rest and get food and all of those things that come with that sanctuary. So this strategy threatened to take that sanctuary away. They needed it right across the border in Afghanistan, also in part because they were facing intensified drone strikes in Pakistan, where they had that sanctuary. So they needed the Afghan sanctuary, and this threatened to take it away.
So how do we know that bin Laden knew Jim was to blame for this strategy?
Well, this happened somewhat later, after we both returned from Afghanistan. We were contacted by people who had access to government information, and they let it be known that when this raid on Osama bin Laden's his home in Abbottabad took place, one tribe at a time, Jim's paper was discovered in Osama bin Laden's personal living quarters with notes in the margin, apparently written by bin Laden. And along with the documents was also a directive from bin Laden to his intelligence chief saying that Jim should be killed. So that was a very, that sent chills down our spine to realize how strategically important this was, and that even our worst enemy had recognized the value of it.
War correspondent Ann Scott Tyson has written the book American Spartan about Jim Gant, who was a Green Beret, a Special Forces major. And Jim, you went back in, now this is before bin Laden was killed, but you went back in 2010 for a reunion with a friend. Tell us about that.
Yes, when I was in the Konar in 2003, we were doing a lot of kill and capture missions, and I just by happenstance really came into contact with a tribe and a leader. His name was Malik Norafzal. Malik means tribal chief or leader. And over the course of several months, myself and Malik Norafzal became very close. My men became very close to his tribe. And when I left Afghanistan and did other deployments there and read more and kind of was able to look back on my time in Afghanistan, I realized that the only good or the only gains that we ever made were the time that we spent with Malik Norafzal and his tribe. And so as I began to analyze that and think about it, it fell in line with a lot of the doctrine, a lot of the things that I had learned. And I was a young captain and didn't really understand, you know, the ramifications of exactly what was going on when it went on. And when I wrote One Tribe at a Time, realized that I was going to go back, realized that I was going to be asked to implement this, it was an absolute no-brainer that I needed to speak with Malik Norafzal again. And on a very personal level, I told my father and my family and all the men that I would be able to die a happy man if I could just see Malik Norafzal again and just hold him and tell him that I loved him. And then, so after seven long years, we finally met, and we met in Jalalabad, and the first thing that he asked me was, what took you so long? And so it was one of the highlights of my entire life. And he was a great man, and I will never forget seeing him again.
Because you had real friendships that were cultivated there in Afghanistan. The interpreters, for example, were not just interpreters.
No.
They were your bodyguard, your advisors,
yes,
your interpreters, and you considered them brothers.
Oh, absolutely.
And I could see in the photographs of you with this older gentleman that you considered him family.
Yes, I had considered Malik Norafzal my father. As a matter of fact, again breaking the rules, I got my father into Afghanistan.
Your real father.
My father, James K. Gant, who, you know, I'm very close with, who knew all of the stories about Sitting Bull, about Malik Norafzal. And, you know, I felt like it was very important to get my own father, my American father, to meet my Afghan father. I did that. I was a part of his family. He considered me a son. I considered his sons my brothers. I would have died and killed for them.
Well, you mentioned one thing, bringing your father over was against the rules.
Mm-hmm.
So you were, and you describe, you quote somebody in your book as talking about you, Jim, you are the best soldier I've ever known and the worst soldier I've ever known. And what did that person mean by that?
Oh, I think they meant that, I mean, the best being that he's determined to accomplish the mission. He cares about his men, but he's going to let his guys take candy into the training fields, and they're not going to force them to keep their boots all spiffy and clean, and he might have his hair a little bit too long because he cares about what's important. And it was actually a compliment. It meant he's a soldier's soldier, and he cares about his men and the mission and not about the higher-ups and the rules and regulations.
Now, also, your the way you operated reminded people of Lawrence of Arabia. And somebody dubbed this initiative Project Lawrence for that reason. And what did they mean by that?
Well, the Green Berets take their first inspiration from T. Lawrence or Lawrence of Arabia.
In fact, you quote him in the front of your book.
I do. And in World War I, he worked with the Arab tribes and lived with them.
Dressed
like them, spoke their language, and mobilized them against the Ottoman Empire and the Turks very, very effectively. And that and his writings form some of the core philosophical and tactical base of knowledge for Green Berets. And at a certain point in these conflicts, Admiral Eric Olson, who is the head of U.S. Special Operations Command, realized that there was too much kicking indoors approach going on, and it was necessary to take a more indirect approach, one that did involve a deep knowledge of local cultures and people. And so he set out to look for Army officers or experienced enlisted men who had that cultural knowledge, who could be sent to different parts of the world to do that. And his senior enlisted man, who was Command Sergeant Major Smith, also a longtime Green Beret, recognized one tribe, found one tribe at a time, and that inspired them to call Jim in as their potential first, what they called Lawrence of Afghanistan.
My guests are Anne Scott Tyson, a war correspondent who's written the book American Spartan about her now husband, Special Forces Major Jim Gant. Well, you mentioned earlier that you do come back to the United States, and it was under rather unusual circumstances. First of all, Anne, you weren't even sure you could get out because you didn't have that stamp allowing you into the country to begin with. So Jim is sent home, and then how did you get home?
Well,
home being back to the United States.
Well, the U.S. officers who pulled Jim out also came to me and basically said, "Miss Tyson, we're going to take you back to the base in Jalalabad." And I smiled and said, "Yes, we will." And then in my mind, I said, "No way. You are not taking me anywhere. I am going to preserve my materials, and I am going to leave this place and preserve my ability to document
all your notes and records and photographs.
My notes and photographs and be able to document this story and not have this material fall into their hands." So I essentially walked past a bunch of officers who were searching Jim's quarters, took all my things, and then after they briefly left, with the help of several Afghans, got through, got out of this small camp and passed special forces who were guarding the gate with all of the Afghans who had been so incredibly supportive in our mission, both the tribal police and some of the Afghan interpreters. And they, I left with them. We went to Jalalabad initially, and then I was able to fly back to the United States, completely evading the U.S. military and not giving them any opportunity to speak with me.
Well, when the military removed Jim from command, they also said, you cannot talk to Anne, you cannot communicate with Anne, you can't get within 50 feet of Anne. So this was, I mean, by this time you were in love with each other. And there's a part in your book where you describe what it was like to be away from Jim. And I wonder if you would mind reading that, Anne.
Okay. All that time apart, I had lived with an ache in my chest. It fluctuated between dull and sharp, but never went away. At times, I was so sure Jim had been killed that I stayed away from the front of the house, afraid of looking out the window and seeing uniformed men coming down the walk. It had grown harder, not easier, to cope with the pain of separation. After everything that had transpired, it was crushing me.
And this is from the book American Spartan. This is after Anne Scott Tyson and her war hero, Jim Gant, had returned to the United States. And Jim, I don't know if you want to get into why they removed you from command. Because we just have a little bit of time.
Yeah, sure. I am very upfront and honest about everything that happened. I clearly broke some rules and regulations, which involved the consumption of alcohol,
which everybody did over there.
Yes, everybody did over there. The consumption of sleepy medications. I have a well-documented sleep problem and also, taking pain medications. And what it came down to was I did break some rules and regulations. There was coupled with a personal dislike from some of the new commanders that I had. They had to do something and they did.
Well, it is such a fascinating story. I mean, each of you, we could write a book about your experiences individually, but this is a very fascinating read. We've only gotten to some of the stories, and I appreciate your both coming in today to talk to us about American Spartan. Thank you, Anne Scott Tyson and Jim Gant. The book is American Spartan, The Promise, The Mission, and The Betrayal of Special Forces Major Jim Gant. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.